listen to the Rogue Startups Podcast, where two startup founders are sharing lessons learned and pitfalls to avoid in their online businesses. And now, here's Dave and Craig.
All right, welcome back to another episode of the Rogue Startups Podcast. Today, Dave is off this week, and I have Ed Freifogel on the show. Ed, how you doing?
I'm doing well. I'm doing great. I'm sitting here in sunny Barcelona. So looking forward, a long time listener to the podcast, and it's great to finally be on.
Awesome. Well, it's good to have you. And, I hope that all the sort of revolutionary talk down in Barcelona has quieted down at this point. Is that accurate, or are things still kind of in a fury?
No. That's not accurate at all. Actually, this week we had a kind of another little flare up because, I don't follow it as closely perhaps as I should, but, I don't know if you saw, but, the Catalan president was, taken into custody in Germany. And so now they have to decide if they're going to extradite him. Also, some other people were imprisoned. So no, it's not solved at all. Actually,
it's not over, huh? That's incredible.
It's going to fester for a long time, I think.
Yeah.
So, we can get into that, but I don't think, you know, that's more like a good conversation to have over some wine and,
yeah,
if you have a full night ahead of you.
Right, for sure. No, so Ed and I met at MicroConf Europe, where he was a speaker and gave a really interesting talk about sort of regional pricing stuff. But for the folks who don't know you, can you give kind of a background on who you are and what you do?
Right. So although I live in Barcelona, I'm not Catalan or Spanish. I'm half German, half American. I run a small SaaS business together with one other partner. It's called the OpenCage Geocoder. And it's a service that we provide a geocoding API. So geocoding is the process where if you have an address, you might need the coordinates, or if you have the coordinates, you might need the address. And you can do that with our API. I've been doing that for about 3 years. And that was kind of an offshoot of another business that I had, which I worked on the 10 years prior to that, which was a real estate search engine. Which was much more kind of traditional startup. So I founded that with another guy in 2006 in London. We had investors, ran that business for about 10 years, eventually growing it to about 20 employees. And 2015, we sold that business to one of our competitors and did quite well out of that. And so that gave me the chance to then kind of switch gears in life and move to Barcelona and take it a little bit easier. But the acquirer was not interested in this geocoding piece, which we had developed there. And so myself and one of my colleagues from that business, we took that over and we've been running it as a SaaS business ever since.
Gotcha. I have two things I really want to dig into about kind of your journey and your business. I'll touch on your talk from MicroConf Europe because I really think it's an interesting thing to maybe start on, and then we can dig into kind of where you are now. But you talked about regionally displaying pricing information as a way to kind of connect with your potential customers. So you run a SaaS business or an e-commerce business, instead of presenting all of your pricing information in dollars or euros or pounds, you know, give the six or seven most common currencies to your customers based on kind of their IP address, and then display their regional currency. And then you can do all the conversions on the back end after the purchase is made. Instead of me butchering that anymore, do you want to kind of give the 10,000 foot view of your talk and why some folks might think about doing this with their business?
Right. So our business is very global. We have customers on six different continents. It's a service that people all over the world need. So we're trying to attract customers from all over the world. You know, when you think about it, with most SaaS businesses, when you think about how to optimize your business, it's all about how do I convey to the customer what exactly I do? How do I get them to trust me? How do I convince them I have built the solution that's right for them? And many people do this. And then when the guy goes to pay, he clicks on the pricing page and all of a sudden you show him the price in a different currency, typically in US dollars. You've spent all this work to say, I have the right solution for you. I understand your problem. I'm ready to help you. And then you say, but not really, because you need to pay in a different currency. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. So there's kind of a contradiction there. And typically that's because I guess it's obviously easier to charge only in one currency, easier for you to run your business in one currency. But you know, if you're doing everything to just make life easy for you, that's kind of the opposite of what you should be doing. You should be doing everything to make life easy for your customer. And of course, you need to find ways to optimize that on your side as well. But, you know, you need to make it simple for the customer to understand your service and to purchase your service. And so if the price is not in his currency, you've just created a hurdle,
yeah.
Right? Now he now has to mentally calculate that. And obviously that's not rocket science. People from, let's say, small countries with less well-known currencies, they're probably used to doing that. But it's a subtle signal that you're telling the guy, look, I don't really want you as my customer.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Really what I want is just people who have US dollars.
Or
really
I didn't build this for you at least. Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. I didn't build this for you. I built it for people who can pay in euro, not for people who can pay in Swiss francs.
Yeah.
For example. And the thing is, this is actually not technically complex and people love it. So if you think about, you know, we have a decent number of Canadian customers, for example. It's something they always comment on, that they're like, they're so used to, you know, Canada is kind of viewed as like, you know, basically part of the US market because they speak English and it's, you know, it's pretty similar. So, and then they get to the pricing page and I show them the price in Canadian dollars and they say, and people really comment on it and always choose to do it. And it's just an easy way to differentiate from your competitors. And frankly, it's not, as I said, it's not technically complex. It's not expensive. I mean, maybe it costs you maybe like 2-3% or whatever, but you know, most SaaS businesses, you're always running kind of promos and discounts or whatever. You would be happy to give a customer a 10% discount, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So if I give him a you know, if I build in a 3% cost for me, then, you know, fine.
Yeah.
Then there's another piece to it. So that's one thing in like, let's say developed markets, like, you know, the European markets or North America, Canada, and the US. And then you also have customers in, or at least we have customers, you know, in, let's say, developing markets where our most basic pricing tier is $50 a month. And, you know, that's not nothing, but in Western Europe or in the US, someone who's using our service, $50 is not a lot of money. Okay. But maybe for the guy in Brazil or in South Africa or wherever, it is a lot in that market. So, you know, by showing the price in his currency, I can actually charge a lower price that is more reflective of what people in that market are able to bear, the price they're able to bear.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's a way to kind of price discriminate so that I still get those people who can't pay $50, but the people who can pay $50 pay $50. So
yeah,
that was kind of the crux of my talk.
Yeah, so I've seen that a little bit here, living in Europe for a year and a half. That the price elasticity for customers in the U.S. is much higher than people in Europe. I think people in Europe tend to want to pay less than folks in the U.S. So even between euros and dollars, I think you could look at, you know, maybe relatively pricing things lower in Europe than in the U.S.
I think that depends heavily on maybe what target market, what sector you're in,
sure.
And what the services you're offering or whatever. I mean, we find the opposite in some cases.
Mm.
So like in Northern Europe, let's say Germany, Scandinavia, price is not really the driving issue. Price, it's much more, can they trust you? Are you a solid solution? Are they, you know, is the service still going to be there in 2-3 months, or are they going to have to replace you with something else? It's not about saving 5 or 10%.
Yeah.
Then you do have other markets that are more cost sensitive, Southern Europe, or, you know, where people complain about the price or whatever. But I think it depends heavily on what service, you know, is this a discretionary purchase or is it something they have to have, things like that.
Sure, sure. Fair enough. Cool. No, so I think the talk was great and the lesson I think is really good. And whether it's showing currencies, different currencies for different people depending on where they live or other things that customize the pricing page and the checkout experience for your customers is really something that we all should think about and kind of explore, I think, in our businesses because it really is probably the last or one of the big things that people look at with purchasing your product. And the more you can make it connect with them and work with kind of their needs, the better. So yeah, I thought it was a great talk, and would love to see more people do this kind of stuff.
Thanks. I really think it's a pretty low hanging fruit. You know, it's not that complicated to set up, and you know, for better or worse, a lot of the let's say leading voices in the SaaS community and the people giving the advice, it all comes from America. Mm-hmm. And you know, typically these are very smart people who have built great businesses and things. So there's a lot to learn there. But America is such a big market; it's easy just to focus on the U.S. But if you just make a little bit of effort, you can really start attracting customers from all over the world, right? And I really think it gives you a much more solid foundation for your business.
Yeah.
And more to the point, if you don't do it, probably of course some competitor will.
Right.
So.
Right.
You know, it's probably something people should have on their list.
Cool. So, love to talk about the real estate search engine business that you guys built up and sold. Because I think a lot of us are kind of at the stage in our businesses where we have a business that's doing well, they're just getting off the ground, and we have product market fit. But to think about a business that has 20 employees and is presumably doing kind of millions of dollars a year is like a whole nother world. I'll speak for myself, right? So I have a business that has traction, is getting off the ground, but then to think about running a business with like multiple offices and managers and stuff like that is something that would be cool and great, but I kind of can't imagine. Can you talk about like how that process went for you guys? I mean, I know it was over like 10 years or something.
Sure.
Like
so,
that. But yeah.
Yeah. We're going back deep into internet ancient history here. So that was in 2006, maybe very briefly. So I started my career in the late 90s, the internet 1.0, at working at Yahoo, back when Yahoo was the cool place to be. And I worked there for 5 years, based in Munich. And the last couple of years there, I worked on search. And this was at the kind of time period when paid search had just been invented. Google was just starting to grow. So Yahoo and Google were battling. Lots of ups and downs, of course, with the whole internet bust in 2001. Anyway, in 2003, I left Yahoo and I went and got an MBA because at Yahoo, I'd been a software developer. And I realized I liked knowing kind of how it worked, but I also wanted to learn more about the business side of things and maybe do something else. And the other thing was that in my time at Yahoo, when I joined Yahoo Germany in 1998, it was quite small. It was 15 people. Mm. And I'd really enjoyed that. And by the time I left, it was 200 people. So it was a fantastic experience for me. I learned a lot, grew a lot. But I also realized that I had enjoyed it much more when it was still small. So in 2005, I was finishing my MBA and I was trying to decide what I wanted to do. And I realized I had really enjoyed living in Europe and I had really enjoyed working at a small tech company. And so I thought, let me go find an interesting small tech company, where I can use my knowledge of search, which was clearly a booming industry. And at that time, the best place to do a startup, or that probably the only place in Europe to do a startup, was London.
Hmm.
And I had some friends who lived in London. So I thought, let me move to London. Obviously, it's a very cool city. So I arrived in London and I started looking around trying to find interesting startup to join. And I couldn't quite find the right business where I liked the people, the business, what my role would be. And so in the end, I ended up starting a business together with another ex-Yahoo colleague. And we thought, let's build something around in search and search in different categories. And our first category we would start on would be real estate. So I had a great co-founder. So I handled more of the product and engineering side of things. And he handled more of the business side of things. My number one advice to you, to anyone wanting to do a startup, he was a bit, he was about 10 years older than me, much more experienced in business. So my first bit of advice to everyone is have very rich friends. So he had several rich, let's say, friends, acquaintances who were very quickly willing to finance us. And they became our angel investors. So actually, you know, if you look online, there's all this discussion about, oh, it's so hard to raise money and how to raise money and this whole process. But actually for us, it went surprisingly quick. So that's my main advice, is know lots of rich people.
Yeah, for sure.
And with that, we were able to get going. And so we started that business. If you want, I can get to the mechanics of the business, but basically, you know, we found our niche. We were able to get the first customers, and we took a very cautious approach, though, in terms of you know, never overextending ourselves, growing only as and when kind of the revenues could support it, which had many, many positive aspects to it. In hindsight, it also had some negative aspects to it, and we eventually faced some competitors who took a much more aggressive approach in terms of expanding much more quickly. And eventually, you know, fast forward to 2015, we sold to one of those competitors who had succeeded with their more aggressive approach, which, you know, there were a lot of steps on the journey. In that time, so I was in London from 2005 to 2015, deep in the startup scene, watching that all grow. I mean, now London is massive. There, you know, every door you knock on is a startup incubator.
Yeah.
You know, all kinds of people doing very, very interesting things. Lots of success stories in the meanwhile. So that was a great journey. That was a great. I enjoyed it a lot and learned a lot. Met many, many interesting people. And the great news is that now that culture has kind of spread much more across Europe. Here in Barcelona, now we also have lots of startups and incubators, not quite at London scale, but obviously now you have Berlin, you have lots of other cities that are where things are happening. But also now more and more you have this culture of people like yourself kind of living in, let's say, more off the beaten path areas, running their own business. I also think in many ways now it's gotten much easier. So, you know, one or two guys can build a really, you know, great business. The tools have gotten much simpler. You know, the technical tools that you don't have to have your own servers. You can just use some cloud servers and things like that. You can keep your costs much lower. In some ways, though, of course, it's gotten harder.
Yeah,
it's harder and harder to find an interesting niche that someone else has not already taken. It's harder and harder to cut through the noise. I mean, people are, while people spend more and more time online on digital services, it's harder and harder to get their attention.
Yeah. Yeah.
But on the other hand, I also think particularly for us as SaaS businesses, more and more that the model of SaaS has become accepted. People are more and more willing to put a credit card, you know, into a web page and purchase things, not just for themselves, but as a one-time e-commerce purchase, but also as like for their business and to depend on third-party infrastructure providers and things like that. I'm also quite hopeful, you know, with GDPR coming up. I know everyone in the industry is spending their time kind of moaning and complaining about it, about the work it causes, but I view it as a huge positive in that it should hopefully create a lot more trust amongst consumers, and thus a lot more willingness to engage with digital services, purchase digital services, sign up for a subscription, this kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
So let's see.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think GDPR, to your last point, is something that people are kind of struggling to get the first steps in place to be compliant or to think they're compliant and get some technical and some documentation and some process in place. But after that, I agree that it will give people, the consumers and our end users, control over what's going on and their information. And hopefully we'll continue the growth of adoption of purchasing digital things. Because I think for some people, it's still more on a enterprise level business sense, probably, it is a bit of a barrier to entry. People have questions about their privacy and what's going on. So, yeah, I mean, I think GDPR, say, a year from now will be viewed as a very positive thing. The next 6 months will probably be difficult.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And we're seeing in our own business now, we've been doing it for 3 years as a kind of standalone brand, and we're seeing more and more interest from enterprises, which, you know, doesn't mean it's easy to sell them. But you know, whereas previously businesses always had the mindset, oh, I need to do it myself, or I need to do it in-house, or I need to, okay, maybe I can pay, the big tech giants of the world to do this, but I could never trust a small business. Now, more and more, there's increasing willingness. So I see that as quite a positive trend that we hope to keep riding.
So going back to, you guys built the real estate search engine or search business, and then you had some outside investment to get it off the ground. I'd love to hear some more about kind of things you learned as you built the business and grew the team from you and your co-founder and some investors to kind of a bigger team. How many people did you guys have on your team when you sold?
I'd say we probably had around 20 at that point. Usually we probably maybe about 15 full time, and then we always had several kind of students doing internships with us and things like that.
Yeah.
We also had employees kind of, we had a guy based in Bangalore who, actually, normally you hear of a company that has people in India and you think it's because they're trying to reduce their costs or whatever, but that wasn't the case for us. He was our country manager for India. And India, by the end, when we started focusing on the UK market. By the end, we're doing 10 different markets, and India had become our biggest market.
Wow.
And that really exploded when we got my colleague in India, and we got him on board. And what we saw is that a room full of Europeans is perhaps not the optimal group of people to build a service for India.
Yeah, for sure.
So we needed we needed someone with the local knowledge and the local connections, and someone who would actually go visit our customers and engage with them. And that our business exploded once we found that guy.
Yeah,
he was great.
So for folks who are, like even for you guys where you are with your business right now, you have it's just you and your co-founder now. But like looking back on your experience with your previous business, if you were looking to say, okay, in the next 2 to 3 years, I think we're going to bring on a handful like full-time people. What are some things that like I could be thinking about as I'm like, okay, we're going to be getting big, quite a bit bigger, and we're going to need team and infrastructure and process and all this stuff that it's me and a couple of contract developers and support people now, but we're going to be quote a real company in a couple of years. What like as people are getting their heads around getting ready for that, what advice would you offer?
I have to say this was one thing that changed quite a bit over the 10 years in that it became much, much more competitive to attract talent, at least in London. Because when we started, there were very few interesting startups. And it was, the challenge was much more convincing someone why they shouldn't join, let's say, some big company. Why should you not go join Microsoft or whatever? And why should they instead take a chance on your startup? And by the end, the problem was there were thousands of startups. And frankly, everyone wanted to start their own startup in London. So it became very difficult to recruit people, keep them. Even if you could get them, how do you keep them engaged with the business so that they don't quit after 2 years? That was a big challenge. But to your question for your business, I mean, the first question I think you would have to answer is the question of location. So are you going to, on your transition to being a, quote, real business, are you going to have one office or are you going to be a distributed team?
Mm.
And obviously that has huge implications in terms of who you can recruit. I work with several different startups kind of in an advisory role or as an investor. And this is a challenge many of them are facing now because many people want to experiment with kind of having a remote team because it opens up the gates of who you can recruit. But it also has a lot of challenges, of course.
Yeah.
And second of all, you want to make sure, how do you make sure that someone's joining your business because they're really interested in your business and your product and what it is you're trying to build, rather than just because you say, fine, you can live on the beach in Portugal.
Right.
So that's a real challenge. And also how do you create a coherent culture when your team is distributed all over the place? And so I think that's kind of the first question you would have to answer is, are we going to be in one location? Definitely makes it easier to create a coherent culture, to have a sort of a team vibe, but probably deeply limits your recruiting pool.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, here in Annecy, I'm sure there's high quality development talent around, but I can't. I don't know. So, I mean, that's interesting. I've, for the last 2 years, obviously run just remote companies, and I can't imagine opening an office. But I know plenty of people kind of in our world that do it and swear by it. So.
Yeah, yeah. So, but see, if you have a remote team all over the world, then you have all kinds of issue in that. While this has become more and more a normal way for people to work, you know, the bureaucracy hasn't caught up. Like, are they going to be employed by you? How are you going to do that if they're in different countries? Are they just going to be freelancers? If so, you know, what stops them from quitting whenever they want? You know, like, how do you, also how are you going to pay them? Who pays the taxes? All the, you know, all this kind of stuff that can be a bureaucratic nightmare.
Yeah, I mean, I think the tax point is interesting because I think in a way. We're sort of de-incentivized from hiring local people. So, right, you know, in the U.S., I would much rather hire someone who lives in Canada as a developer or in South America or anywhere else, basically, so I don't have to deal with all of the tax bullshit in the U.S. And the same with our French business. We were looking at hire a French developer. And, yeah, it's much, much, much easier for us to hire someone outside of France from a tax and
well, it's easier for you, but it might not be easier for them. If
that's true.
You know, then they have to handle all that, so that's a negative for them potentially. But also, then how do you create a unified culture? How do you what some people try to do, of course, is you have a remote team, and then once a quarter you bring everyone together for a week or something, but. Mm-hmm. That's then also work. Someone has to manage that, coordinate that, plan that. So that's not simple.
Yeah.
I also think there's huge benefit to everyone being in one place, and particularly at the early stages, you know, when you're trying to create a culture. You know, now with my co-founder, he is based in Germany, but we've worked together. He actually worked together with me at Yahoo previously. So we've worked together for almost 20 years.
Yeah.
So we know each other very, very well. We trust each other. I don't need to, monitor his working hours or anything like that. You know, we just trust that we're both doing the best we can to push things forward. When you start hiring people you don't know, it's a challenge.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think the remote thing for us has been successful. I don't have any major things from a culture perspective that I feel like we're lacking. I do want to get our team together at some point, which would be very expensive, which is, I think, the reason a lot of people don't do it. But I think that would be really great. We're starting to do more video calls. We've typically just done kind of audio calls. We're starting to do more video calls, like every call we do. With the Castos team, it is on video so that we can see each other's faces and where our offices are and things like that.
Which has been
helpful in kind of creating a real kind of sense of team. And yeah, I mean, your point of how do you know that your contractors aren't just going to quit one day is something I definitely think about, especially being a non-technical person. I mean, we have several people who can help with most parts of our business at this point. But if they all left, I would be totally screwed.
Well, of course. But how do you get people, also how do you create a culture where people really want to go the extra mile, where they want to, not just do their project, but do it in a way that to make sure that the next guy, you know, it's easy to maintain and easy to understand. So in my experience, when we were in London, we were all in one office, obviously. We used to invest heavily, heavily in our team. So once a year we would do a big team retreat where we would go. My co-founder was from the Basque Country, from Bilbao. So we would fly everyone to Bilbao and do a big like 3-4 days in Bilbao and go surfing. And this was always a highlight of the year. And when I look back on those 10 years and all the, all the different events, what stands out isn't like, oh, we launched feature X or, oh, we won this big contract. And then, we got some key customer. It's things like that. It's like, oh, I remember that time we all went to Bilbao, or remember that great summer party we had, or and it's the relationships you have with the people. Mm-hmm. And that's one thing I have to say that I kind of struggle with now with our much smaller remote business. Most of the time, I love my business because it gives me huge flexibility, and I can I have two kids, so I can deal with my kids whenever I want and things like that. But you know, this year at Christmas, on the social media, you know, I would see everyone posting pictures of their company Christmas party or whatever, yeah. And you're kind of like, oh, well, you know, that would be kind of nice to have a. I mean, this is the kind of thing that we used to invest heavily in. We would always have a great party every year at Christmas, and we would always so. It's funny. It's kind of a case of the grass is always greener, I guess. Because right. when you're commuting into work every day to the office, you're always like, oh, you know, this is super inefficient. It'd be better if I could just work from home, or you know, what's the point of us going to the same office? If we're just going to sit there next to each other, staring at our computer screen anyway, you know. Mm-hmm. But then when you look back, you do miss those relationships and those shared experiences.
Yeah.
So that's something I'm still kind of grappling with of how we manage that.
So now your business is just you and your and Mark, right? So it's just the two of you?
Yeah. It's just the two of us working on it. But we have another partner in – so legally we're a UK business because that was where the old business was when we spun it out. So we have a partner there who kind of handles some of the, let's say, the finance stuff, like making sure the taxes get paid and –
yeah,
but he's involved pretty peripherally with the business. Then we do have a kind of network of contractors we work with, some regularly, so some are doing a certain number of days a month with us, but they're not involved day to day, let's say.
Gotcha. So I'd be interested to hear, you know, now kind of seeing both sides of the coin, right? Running a large locally based business before and now you guys are kind of smaller and distributed. How do you view the difference between the two?
Well, it's hard to say because I also think my life has changed a lot in the sense of, you know, when we started that business in London in 2005, I was obviously much younger, but you know, I was like a young single guy. I didn't mind, you know, working. I would work a lot and then I would go out a lot in London. I was totally embracing that kind of lifestyle.
Yeah.
And I loved it.
Yeah.
Now I'm married. I have two kids. You know, so now I value things like I go pick up my kids when they're done with school. I take them to school every morning. So, you know, as your life evolves, you value very different things. And that was one thing that struck me at MicroComp at MicroComp Europe in November. There were a lot of people I felt like who were kind of had made the transition to parenthood. And one of the reasons they had switched to kind of a micro SaaS business was exactly for the much better lifestyle for their family.
Mm-hmm.
So, as I said, the grass is always greener. I mean, there are definitely things I miss about the big. It wasn't a big company; it was a small company. But the having more people. I try to. There are two ways I try to keep that alive. And get the benefits of that is that one is I run when I lived in London, I had an event that I ran every couple months, kind of a meetup for location-based service developers. And I still run that. So I go back every 2 months to London and run it. It's not a lot of effort now that I have everything set up.
Yeah.
And the flights are very cheap. That's one great benefit of living in Barcelona. It's very easy to go to London. And the perverse thing about that is, so I go back to London every 2-3 months for this event, and there are a lot of people that when I lived in London, I only saw them every 2 or 3 months.
So it's the same, right?
So my relationship with them has not changed at all. So that's great. So in that I have the benefits of all the worlds. I mean, here in Barcelona, you know, I'm sitting right now looking out on the Mediterranean, overlooking my terrace, it's blazing sun. But when I want the excitement of the big city, I go back to London very easily. The other way I try to, you know, the other thing you can do is go work at a co-working space. There are lots of them here in Barcelona, or I try to, I'm involved with several different startups here in Barcelona that I, sometimes I'll go work from their offices or meet them or, you know, they ask me for advice about the different problems they're having or whatever. And so you can kind of dip your toes back in that water.
No, that's great. There's a group here in France that has a meetup probably just a couple times a year in Paris. And I'm probably going to go to the next one that they have there because I think it is great. I mean, I look at these conferences mostly these days as being kind of two ends of the spectrum for me. One is really sort of inspirational. And so some of these conferences with like big, huge companies, you know, Intercom and all these kind of big, huge monsters.
Right, right.
Them talking about what they're doing. And I'm like, wow, you know, someday I could potentially maybe be there and that would be awesome. But then the other ones, FemtoConf, MicroConf, local meetups are a great chance for me to go learn from my real kind of peers, and just chat and talk and bullshit and have a beer and stuff like that. Cause I mean, I go to a co-working space maybe once a week and it's cool and it's great. And there's some people doing the same kind of things that I am, but here in Annecy, and I think a little bit of, living in a smaller town like this, it's just not really, it's not London or Barcelona or Berlin, where there's a bunch of people doing the same kind of thing. So I have to travel a little bit more than some people. But yeah, I mean, we've talked about this a bunch on the show before, that doing something on a really regular basis is really important to kind of stay grounded. But also, like, I always get such awesome, like, ideas and inspiration and stuff from going to these events. I think it's really, like, it has a lot of positive ROI to my business, I think.
Absolutely. I mean, at MicroConf, I was really surprised at how much, even if you think you know what you're doing and you're reading the blogs and listening to the podcast, there's still always things to learn.
Yeah.
There's always, even if it's just one or two little tips or tricks, they can have a real impact. So, yeah, I really encourage everyone to engage with that. So
now with your geocoding business, you guys run a relatively successful business just with two people. And I know that, like, I think talking about the lifestyle business aspect of things, this is something that people who get into this really strive for, is like, how can I get a business set up and run it and have it just be me and a co-founder and a couple of contractors and be making whatever, 20, 30 grand a month. Are there things you've learned along the way to say, like, I'm not going to build a big business, but I'm going to build a really solid business that makes good profit and affords me to be able to go get the kids from school and live in Barcelona and kind of fuck off whenever I want to, that you've learned along the way?
Well, first of all, you're going to need patience.
Yeah.
You're going to need a lot of patience because, you know, having come from the other end of the startup spectrum where it's all about let's go faster and we have money, let's spend the money, you know, and attack and let's hire more people. And, you know, with the SaaS business, I just think maybe you get lucky and you find some niche that no one has noticed before and you know, the customers are tearing your door down. But at least in our industry, that's not the case. And it's much more about you just have to be patient and it's customer by customer. And you have to accept there are going to be ups and downs, and you just have to be able to take a long view on that. And so maybe that also requires, you know, having a financial cushion that lets you do that.
Yeah.
Or throttling down your lifestyle so that you're not burning cash. So, I mean, my co-founder Mark Tobias, he was doing and still occasionally does various freelance projects on the side. Now more because he finds them interesting and stimulating and his chance to learn new things or help people that he wants to help. But initially, of course, it was to make money.
Mm-hmm.
Because the business couldn't afford for us, both to be working on it full time. So that's the main thing, is you just have to have patience. And what I see also now, as I said, we're starting to be approached by more and more kind of bigger companies and enterprise companies. And, you know, at least in our industry, no one's going to purchase from you. No big company is going to purchase from you if you say, like, oh, I've been around for the last 3 weeks.
Right.
They're just like, well, you know, that seems risky.
Mm-hmm.
So now that we've been around for 3 years, you know, people start to, you know, people have heard your name once or twice and they say, oh, okay, this, you know, these guys have been here. You have some testimonials on the site. You have, you've convinced people. Like, it just takes a long time. It takes a long time, at least in the sector that we're in. So for us, it's difficult to get customers, but then we also generally don't lose the customer as long as we're kind of a utility in that, people are purchasing our service because they need it. not because it's fun or it's not discretional. They need geocoding.
Yeah.
And then once they buy it, as long as it's working and the price is reasonable, which our prices are, you know, they don't switch. So it's much more a game of how do I get the customer? And then once I get him, typically he stays.
Yeah.
But that takes time. That takes time. But what we're seeing now, you know, and definitely in the first year or two, there are times you're like, oh my God, you know, this is going to take forever. But now we see it kind of has kind of, it's like compound interest. It goes slow, slow, slow. And then it starts building and building. And for the first time, you hear cases of, you know, customer A referred us to customer B and things like that. It starts to really build up.
Yeah. No, I mean, this is for sure. I mean, we're really just starting to see this with Castos, where we've been public with kind of our paid product for almost a year now, so like 10 months. And I feel like it's been 10 months of just like scraping by and barely making everything work. And now like it's just getting a little easier, where yeah. like we're getting customers, our support is not as high because we have less bugs. We have revenue that can support our developers and our support people and our monstrous AWS bill every month. Cause I mean, we're not a kind of a lightweight app. We're a hosting provider. So it's just very kind of resource intensive, but
that would be my first advice to you, get off AWS, man. That's just you know, AWS is a great machine for making Bezos even richer.
Yeah.
I mean, we don't use AWS. I mean, we have our own servers, with a great provider in Germany, and you know, the bill is half of what AWS would be.
Really? Really?
So yeah. that would be my other advice, is you have to be frugal. You have to, you know, and that's part of patience. It's like, of course I would love to say, all right, next month, let's do it. You know, let's blow a ton of money on marketing. But instead we take a much more frugal approach and we say, okay, you know, next month we have this much to spend. We're going to do this experiment. If that works, you know, then in 2 months we're going to do the next experiment or whatever. But, you know, but being frugal, I mean, one thing we do is so one way we try to keep our business simple is we try to build very structured habits. And this was also something we did at my old business, is that we, you know, rather than just always saying like, okay, let's do project A, then let's do project B, then let's do project C, and you do it on whatever, you know, sprint cycle you have or whatever. We did do that, but we would also have certain things that we would set aside time. So we found our service, the one thing that really influenced our service was the speed of the site. Mm. So once a month we would have a thing called Speed Day, where everyone in all the engineers would work just on making the site faster. Okay. And so in our current business, what we do is we have once a quarter, we might have Speed Day. Then once a quarter, we have Upgrade Day. So where we upgrade everything. Once a quarter, we have, you know, I go through all of our costs and make sure, you know, is there anything we can do to reduce our costs? And rather than just doing this in kind of a hodgepodge way where you're like, oh yeah, let me check on our costs, we set aside, you know, first day of the quarter, we look at our costs or whatever, and we make sure, okay, we should move this to an annual subscription. Oh, you know, this competitor, you know, we're using service X, but, you know, this other service is a better deal now for us. So let's switch to that one. Or, you know, our usage went up and so we got bumped to a new price here, but maybe by tweaking these things, we can get our usage back down or things like that.
Mm-hmm. And so doing it just like once a quarter or something, instead of constantly having all this stuff rotating through your to-do list, right?
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So we try to build very disciplined habits like that. And then that way I know the rest of the quarter, I don't need to worry about that because I'll get to it when the next day we do, you know, cost analysis day.
Yeah.
And as a result, you know, then I can say, well, I don't need to worry about that. Today I'm going to go play with my kids or whatever. Right. And we try to be very disciplined. Like we have certain times when we do certain things and the rest of the time I don't worry about it.
Yeah. Do you guys use a tool to kind of manage your schedule, like a project management tool, or how does your business run from that perspective?
Yes, we have a text file that we call our
the Bible.
plan.txt, and that's how we do it. I mean, that's viable because we're only two people, or you know, really only two people who need the plan. I mean, we are more people, but that's not true. We use Trello for the actual, you know, the specific points of, you know, what we need to remember to do this or that or whatever, or this little project. But we, again, that's where we try to be frugal. Like, I know, of course I could spend money on the base camps of this world or whatever, but we keep it simple.
Yeah. No, that's great. That's great. I think that's hugely important. I think one other thing to kind of touch on is, and you mentioned this before, is kind of being patient and taking time to get there. And Dave and I have talked a little bit on the show about growth rates that people can expect. But I think more and more, kind of as just having gone through kind of the almost the first year of a SaaS project, I think that to realistically expect to be profitable being you make money and take it home and have the business run, I think that folks need to plan on it taking at least a year.
Yeah, definitely. I would say more like two.
Yeah.
I really think it is like, you know, compound interest in a bank account, in that when you look at a compound interest curve, if you look at the first part of the curve, you know, it looks like it's barely going up. And then all of a sudden, like, you know, the compounding really starts working.
Yeah.
The other bit of advice I would have is we have been very good at growing with our customers. So really investing in, you know, how do you get your customers to upgrade? How do you get your customers to spend more? I think that many people undervalue that. And some other SaaS founders, I know they spend a lot of their time on marketing, on how do I get new customers? And obviously that's important. You need to get new customers, but you shouldn't underestimate, once someone has already committed to being your customer, they already trust you and you already have their, you know, their payment details on hand. You know, it should be possible to of course you have to provide more value to get them to spend more, but that should be your upselling, I think, is very undervalued.
Yeah. Do you guys do that from a perspective of offering existing products that you already have, or do you put a lot of effort towards, we are going to go spend the next quarter to build a product so that we can offer this to customers and have them pay more money?
Well, our pricing is based on usage.
Okay.
So if you're using more, you need to pay more. But the question is, when do you, and we do this still very manually. It's of course a question of when do you push someone to pay more? How do you phrase that to them? How do you push them so that you say, you know, get them to become pay annually instead of paying monthly, these types of things. I think these are very underutilized skills. This is something I would wish there were more discussion of, kind of in the podcasts and things like that, of tips and techniques around that. Actually, I just sent yesterday a fairly lengthy email to Mike from MicroConf about possible topics for next year at MicroConf, or for this year at MicroConf Europe. And these were some of the things that I really focus on, is like when and how to raise prices, when and how to, you know, the techniques for getting a customer to spend more, getting a customer to move from monthly billing to annual billing.
Yeah.
And I really think there's an art to it. So
this is something I've thought about. So I want to dig into this more. So Castos podcast hosting, we have a single plan right now. Well, monthly or annually, but we charge one plan. And I think it's kind of a selling point. About half the people in our industry have this kind of flat rate, you know, upload and podcast as much as you want, and that's fine. The other half have it based on the amount you upload, which is silly because, like, the cost from our perspective is on bandwidth and people downloading it.
Well, not just that, but you want them to upload as much as possible, right? You want them to use your service. You want them to get as deeply engaged with your service as possible, not say, like, oh, I better not upload this because it's going to, you know, make
our Right. So I think I'm pretty happy with having a flat plan, because from a cost and profitability perspective, I think it's working out okay for us. But yeah. I would like some upward mobility in our pricing. I don't want to charge people more just to do what we're already doing, but would like to get more than $15 a month out of some of our customers. What have you done that is kind of like something that relatively easy for me or other people listening to do, to say, like, either convert to an annual plan or kind of increase usage to move up to a different plan or something like that?
Well, I guess it would depend a lot on who your customers are and things like that, but I would definitely recommend you should have some sort of premium plan. So keep your $15 a month as the base plan and then have a premium plan and, you know, have some sort of additional features that, that unlocks.
Yeah.
I don't know what that would be, but, I mean, I'm sure you're talking with your customers. What are the things that they value and what that they can.
Okay. So how do you guys incentivize people to move to annual plans? I'm sure you have like the 2 months free or whatever, but technically how do you kind of run those campaigns?
Well, you can obviously you got to look at their history. So now that we've been going for a couple of years, you have their history and you say, look, you've been on a monthly plan for, you know, 18 months. You're throwing money away here.
Okay.
Like, and are you, unless you're not happy with our service and you have, do you see any realistic chance that you're going to quit because you've been with us for 18 months? So, you know, why wouldn't you? You know, you might do things like, okay, you know, I'm going to move you up to the next tier, but because you've been with us for a long time, I'm going to give you a 10% loyalty discount or something. Mm. You know, things like that that make the pill easier to swallow. What are some other tips and tricks we try to do? We one big challenge, you probably don't have this in your business. In your business, you're serving podcasters who, by definition, are people who like to talk, I would guess.
Yep. Yep.
So it's easy for you to talk with your customers, right? And in the limit, you can listen to their podcast so you know exactly who they are, you know exactly, you have some idea of who they are, why they're doing this. That's a big challenge for us because our service is just an API. So I see requests coming to my API and we answer them, but I don't really know how they're using our service on their side. So I always have to think of ways of how I can create a conversation with my customers. Because, you know, as I said, we're a utility. So you need to imagine us the same way you imagine your electricity company or your water company. You know, you don't really want to talk with your water company. You
right.
just want to.
Right. Okay. You just want to work. Yeah.
Okay. And you want the price to be fair. And that's it. Like end of discussion. Then you want to go, you know, go drink a beer or whatever. You don't. So I need to always think about ways of how I can get the customers to want to have a conversation with me.
Yeah.
So for example, one thing we offer is our second month free plan. So what I tell people is, look, I'll give you your second month free if you do a 15-minute Skype call with me.
Oh, I love it. Okay.
So that way, but it's not the first month free, because what I don't want is someone that just does that and then they, you know, then they get 1 month free and they cancel. It has to be the second month free.
Yeah.
So you have to show that you're really going to be a customer and that you have to put in a credit card and actually spend some money.
Yeah.
I guess the main thing I try to always emphasize with my customers is we are not trying to squeeze you for a little bit more money 1 month. What we're trying to do is build a long-term relationship with you.
Mm-hmm.
And so this also gets into our pricing, our usage. We do have usage-based tiers, but when you hit your usage cap, nothing happens. You keep going. We don't turn you off. So some of our competitors that, you know, when you go over your usage level, either they turn you off, which is a nightmare for you, or you know, the meter starts running and now you get charged a ton.
Yeah.
And which is also a nightmare because then you're in constant fear all the time of like, oh my God, if my user goes up, I'm going to get this huge bill. Instead, we do nothing. And what we say is, look, you have a usage level. That's what we're going to charge you for. But if you go over it, that's fine. Nothing happens. And if on average over the month, you're always over it, then we're going to send you an email and say, look, it's time to move to the next level. But we're not going to, you know, hit you with some huge bill or turn you off or inconvenience your business because I want you to use more. It's like you with the podcast. You want them to upload more.
Yeah.
The last thing you want is for the guy to be sitting there in a panic about whether or not he should upload because it's going to send him to the next price tier.
Right.
You want him to use as much as possible and to see you as a reliable long-term partner that his business can grow with.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's funny because this takes a long time to convey to some customers. Some customers come from cultures that are very skeptical, that are very used to, as soon as they can, they're going to try to charge me more. They're going to overbill me. They're going to, you know, and it takes a long time to build up that trust with people and say, look, I'm not trying to, you know, I mean, you know, me making $50 more off you in 1 month, who cares? And instead, I'd much rather have you be my customer for the next years.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. I mean, right.
So that's what I mean by you have to have patience. We have the luxury that we're in a position that we can take a very long-term view and build those kind of relationships and actually it's interesting, one of our let's say another player in our space recently, which was kind of a VC funded, or they were backed by a big enterprise, a lot of money poured in, hired a big team, and very suddenly a couple months ago, there was a change of management at the top, and they looked and they're like, oh, this thing is costing us money and not making money, and from one to the next it got turned off.
So
that actually has been great for our business the last couple months, but that's what I mean, like, people, not everyone has the luxury of taking a long-term view, and I think that's one of our key assets. We have two, or let's say several key assets. One asset is that we can take a long-term view. The other is that we're a small, quickly moving team. So when we see a problem, if we need to, we can, we can drop everything else and prioritize some new feature or some new thing that we need. We can do that if we have to. Mm-hmm. Hopefully that's very rare, right? Because we don't want to be ping-ponging around from feature to feature. But if we need to, we can. And those are two big advantages that we have versus the big competitors that we're competing with.
Right. Cool. Well, Ed, this has been great. For folks who want to kind of follow you on online, whatnot, where can they find you and connect?
Right. So first of all, if you need some geocoding, obviously I hope you should check us out.
And yes.
Search for OpenCage Geocoder and you'll find us, or go to opencagedata.com. For me personally, probably the best place is Twitter. That's Freyfogle is my handle, FreyFogle. You can go to freyfogle.com if you want to see my very rarely updating blog. Feel free to ping me on Twitter if anything I said was of interest. As I said, very interested in, particularly here in Barcelona, trying to set up some kind of regular meetup of SaaS founders, but we haven't really managed to get that going yet. So that's one of my goals for this year, to get some kind of a quarterly dinner or something going. So, if anyone out there is listening, and hopefully, at places like, MicroConf Europe and things like that, I look forward to meeting anyone.
Yep. Awesome. Cool. Ed, well, thanks so much. And, we'll see you soon.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Rogue Startups. If you haven't already, head over to iTunes and leave a rating and review for the show. For show notes from each episode and a few extra resources to help you along your journey, head over to roguestartups.com to learn more.